You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of CROI 2010, the 17th Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections. The conference took place in San Francisco, California, from February 16th through February 19th, 2010.
Hi, I'm Miles Helfand, Editorial Director of thebodypro.com. Although conferences such as CROI are research meetings at their core, the findings presented there have an undeniable power to alter clinical practice. As CROI 2010 slips into our rearview mirror, let's take a look at some of its key studies for signs of how the treatment landscape may evolve over the months to come. Joining me for this examination is Joel Gallant, a professor of medicine and epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Dr. Gallant, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Miles.
So we've got a lot of research to get to, and obviously we'd like to put it into as small an amount of time as possible, so let's dive right in. Let's begin with what is always one of the more interesting topics in antiretroviral therapy, the drug development pipeline. What did CROI 2010 bring us?
We hear a lot of complaints that there's not much going on in the pipeline. The pipeline is certainly not as full as it used to be, but there were a few drugs discussed, including a new CCR5 inhibitor, a new integrase inhibitor, and of course the so-called Gilead quad that consists of tenofovir FTC, elvitegravir, which is their integrase inhibitor, and their new booster, GS9350.
Which has a new name, I believe, cobicistat.
That's right, cobicistat. So you need to learn that and be the first on your block to know it.
Or the first in your clinic, I suppose,
right,
as the case may be. So let's get into the quad tablet a little bit. How did this hold up in the study that was presented at CROI?
So actually, there were, Cal Cohen presented three studies in 10 minutes, which was a tour de force because the organizers like to combine related topics and make people have to rush through a lot of data. So he presented the study of the quad compared to a triplet, and then he also presented a study where the cobicistat, or GS9350, was used in comparison with ritonavir to boost atazanavir. And in both studies, the results looked great. These are smaller phase 2 studies, but basically the quad looked comparable in efficacy to a triplet, and the cobicistat looked comparable to ritonavir in terms of its ability to boost atazanavir in that study. But the unexpected finding, especially in the quad versus a triplet study, was that the serum creatinine was slightly higher in the cobicistat arm, or the quad arm. And this resulted in a modest decline in estimated creatinine clearance, which is the way we measure kidney function. This was concerning, of course, because we already know that tenofovir can sometimes affect kidney function, and the idea of developing a quad tablet that had two drugs that were toxic to kidneys was not very appealing. So they then did a quick study in healthy volunteers where they gave cobicistat to people, and they measured their creatinine and their estimated GFR, and then they used what's called iohexol clearance as a test of true GFR. It actually measures creatinine clearance instead of estimating it. And what they found was that while the estimated GFR went down a little bit, the actual GFR didn't change. And their theory is that this is not a kidney toxic drug. It's simply that it inhibits the secretion of creatinine from the kidneys, and therefore it elevates creatinine without actually doing any harm. So that's the hypothesis. They're going to go ahead with the phase 3 clinical trials. The hope is that this is just a tiny decrease in apparent kidney function that occurs within the first week or two, and then from then on remains stable. And so if you needed to monitor for example, tenofovir nephrotoxicity, you'd do it just the way we do now. This was an unexpected finding, hopefully not a big problem. In terms of the ritonavir versus cobicistat comparison, again, as I said, the efficacy was fine. I would say one of the disappointments was that it didn't look better in terms of gastrointestinal side effects than ritonavir. I think we were kind of all hoping that this would be the booster that had none of the baggage that comes with ritonavir, but that, at least in this small study, that didn't appear to be the case.
And now, just to clarify a couple of things quickly, the cobicistat creatinine, I guess, was it a sub-study or was it a separate study that was done in people who received cobicistat monotherapy?
The study where they did the iohexol clearance was a completely separate study in HIV-negative volunteers.
And they didn't receive tenofovir as well?
No, this is just cobicistat.
So there's no way to know necessarily for sure whether there's a potential interaction between cobicistat and tenofovir.
Well, they've done those things before. They've looked at that. There's certainly no pharmacologic interaction. But if you look at the curves that they presented, they were 2 weeks of looking at kidney function after 7 days of monotherapy, the actual GFR is completely stable across those 2 weeks, whereas in the quad versus a triplet study, within a week, you saw this decline in creatinine. So it's a pretty convincing argument, and, you know, there are other drugs we use that do this too. Trimethoprim is a good example. It inhibits creatinine excretion, and you do see a very small increase in creatinine. It's something that we don't even notice or look for, but things are a little different in this case because of the fact that tenofovir is on board. The examples I remember are cimetidine, which used to be used for peptic ulcer disease before we had drugs that had fewer interactions, and trimethoprim. There may have been another example he gave that I'm not remembering.
Is he right in that comparison?
Well, he's certainly right that those drugs do that, and it sounds like he's right that cobicistat doesn't affect true creatinine clearance. Whether the hypothesis that this is due to inhibition of tubular secretion is correct, I don't think we know. It's the assumption that the assumption is based on the fact that other drugs that have this effect on creatinine without actually damaging kidneys do it in this way. So it's a reasonable hypothesis, but probably needs to be established more firmly.
And I imagine phase 3 trials will help too.
Yeah. Well, phase 3 trials will definitely help to determine whether this is indeed a very early problem that occurs quickly and then doesn't progress. That's what we care about. The last thing we want to do is have something that is causing even just an apparent alteration in creatinine clearance, but if it goes on over time, then the problem with that is that it makes it very difficult to monitor for tenofovir toxicity. But if it's just something that happens within a week and then doesn't change, then it's not difficult to monitor for tenofovir toxicity the way we always do.
The quad versus a triplet comparison, was that in treatment-naive patients?
Yes, and that's who this combination is being studied for as a potential replacement for a triplet.
So thus far, from what you've seen, how is it stacking up?
So far, I think it looks very good. I mean, it certainly was associated with a lot fewer neuropsychiatric side effects. So, you know, if you look at things like dreams and dizziness, fatigue, sleepiness, those things were much lower. And so this fulfills, at least in a phase 2 study, seems to fulfill the idea, the promise that it's a drug that's a combination that's as good as a triplet, but without all of the triplet side effects. Now, of course, the quad is not the only combination that's going for that, a triplet place. There are several other competitors that are doing the same thing. So it's just a matter of time, I think, before we have something that's going to be as good as a triplet but better tolerated, and it's a question of which of these various regimens will win.
This may be an overly provocative question, but given that a triplet and quad share two ingredients, how much of a furthering of the evolution of treatment options is the quad drug, really? I mean, given that half of its components are already being utilized in first-line treatment.
I think that where it's an advantage is for patients starting therapy. You know, when I start somebody on a triplet, which is certainly something I use a lot of, I have to spend several minutes sitting and talking about how to deal with getting used to the drug and the changes they're going to go through in terms of the neurologic side effects and the dizziness and the dreams and the difficulty concentrating and the potential for rash. And you know, I can't just hand over a prescription and say, take this once a day. We would love to have a drug or a combination pill that we could just hand a patient a prescription to and say, take this once a day. So we need something without a lot of baggage. I would say this is looking good for that. A triplet has always had, as good as it is and as effective as it is, it's always had its downsides. So while you could say that this isn't all that new, two of the drugs are the same, I think from a patient standpoint, it's very important and new that something replace a triplet. And in fact, all three of the drug regimens that we're looking at now that could potentially replace a triplet have tenofovir and FTC in them.
What are the other ones?
Just a question of the third drug. Well, there's the co-formulation of tenofovir, FTC, and rilpivirine, which is a new NNRTI. And then there's the idea of using tenofovir, FTC, and raltegravir, or Isentress, once a day, which is also being studied.
How important do you feel is the one pill once a day scheme? There are a number of other regimens that are on the preferred list in the, on the U.S. DHHS guidelines, boosted darunavir, for instance, booster raltegravir, that a person could turn to, but that involve more than one pill. Why would they not be preferable, you know, already to, say, a triple or a quad drug?
I think once-a-day dosing is quite important to many, many patients, not all. And there are some that would prefer, for example, Truvada plus Hizentris, even though it's twice a day, just because of the tolerability. And I think the one-pill idea is important to many patients, but again, not all. We have patients who are popping 7 or 8 vitamins a day. You know, they don't care if their meds are 1, 2, 3, or 4 pills a day. It really comes down to side effects and some of the other considerations that we take into account when we start a regimen. I have many patients who come in saying, I want the one pill once a day, I want a tripla, I give them a tripla. And there's always going to be a small number of them who just don't tolerate it and who switch over to, for example, a Truvada plus a boosted PI, and they're happy with the drug because it doesn't have the side effects that they had with a tripla, so they don't mind that it's 3 or 4 pills a day. It just depends on sort of patient preference. For people who have a real pill phobia or who are paying enormous copays on medications, sometimes the number of pills can really make a difference.
Well, it seems like, so then on balance, the further development of the quad tablet is good news then, and we're looking at something that, at least for now, looks like it has the potential to enhance treatment options for naive patients.
Oh, definitely, yeah. And it's wonderful that, you know, it was concerning that L-vitegravir was not going to get developed because, as we'll come to, it's becoming very, very difficult to develop a new drug for a treatment-experienced patient population. And so the development of this booster, cobicistat, it was a big plus because it allowed them to do studies in naive patients. If you remember, this drug was going to need to be boosted by ritonavir, and they couldn't study a ritonavir-containing combination in a naive patient unless it included a protease inhibitor because there was concern that even low-dose ritonavir could lead to drug resistance. So they were kind of stuck with studying this in an experienced population. The booster came along and sort of rescued them, allowing them to use this up front.
Your comment about the difficulty in developing drugs for treatment-experienced patients leads pretty nicely into what might not be as great news as the quad tablet, the results that were presented about the Vicrovirok phase 3 study.
Yeah, so this was a disappointment. This is a presentation by Joe Gaff from the Victor E3 and Victor E4 studies looking at Vicrovirok, which is a CCR5 antagonist, versus placebo plus an optimized background regimen in patients who had extensive treatment experience and R5 tropism. And just to remind people, this is the same study design we have used ever since the Toro studies led to the approval of Fusion. It's been a standard study design where you take people who are experienced, you pick the best combination for them using available drugs, and then they're randomized to either take that combination with the investigational drug or without it. And it served us well. It led to the approval of Fusion, of Prezista, of Celcentri, of Hizentris. All of these recent drugs were approved in this way. And the problem is, I don't think this design works anymore, and this study was a classic example. Because what happened is, even though the drug worked virologically, they couldn't really determine a difference between the people who were on just the background regimen arm versus those who were on the Vicrovirok arm, because the people on the background control arm did so well. And that just reflects the fact that we have lots of drugs we can use now and that most people will do fine with existing drugs. And therefore, the ability to detect a difference using an experimental drug is very low. If you looked at the people in the study, the subset of patients who had 0, 1, or 2 drugs that were active in their background regimen, you did see that Vicrovirok helped, that they had a better response. But overall, the people in the background regimen arm did just as well as the Vicrovirok arm. And so I think this is telling us what we probably already knew, is that this Toro-style study design is not going to work anymore. We're going to have to figure out a new way to get investigational drugs approved if they're being used for treatment-experienced patients. Because it's certainly not ethical to restrict the number of active drugs people get. And yet, without doing that, there's almost no way to see the benefit of your investigational drug.
Now, why is it that the results from this study that were specifically within people who had two or fewer drugs in their, or two or fewer active drugs in their background regimen? There was, I mean, we're talking about a pretty large difference. It was something like 70% in the Vicar-Vyrok arm versus 55% or so in the non-Vicar-Vyrok arm, in the placebo arm, obtained viral loads below 50. Why is that not enough to define superiority?
Well, because it was too small of a number. In the overall numbers, you're looking at almost 500 patients randomized to get Vicar-Vyrok and over 200 randomized to get the placebo. And so that group that had two or fewer active drugs was a subset, and the numbers simply weren't great enough to allow the overall study results to reflect that difference. So essentially, you'd have to either do the study over or somehow continue it out using only patients who met that criterion. It just would be very expensive and would take a very long time to get the study done.
Well, in this case, the maker of the drug has already announced that it's not even going to bother continuing to develop it in treatment-experienced patients.
Yeah, and you look at the way Maraviroc or Celcentri is going, and very few people use it, even though it's a really great drug. I think right now the problem is that the CCR5 antagonists are not probably very exciting to investors and CEOs and boards of directors and those kinds of people, because they see that the first drug in that class is hardly selling at all. And so why come up with a competitor that just has a modest advantage over the one that's already out there and kind of languishing? And I think that's not a function of the drug. It's a function of the fact that we're dependent on a very expensive trophile assay to be able to use the drug. There were some data presented suggesting that we might be able to move towards less expensive genotypic tropism assays in the future, and that would be great because we could potentially even just combine them in with our standard genotypes that we're doing and for a modest increase in cost, get tropism results. And that could really move us to use these drugs more often than we're doing now. But right now, it doesn't look like a very exciting field to get into.
Stepping back a little bit to the broader view of drug development then, is this a regulatory issue or is this a study design issue?
I think in this case, it's hard to know, but I would say it's clearly a study design issue. And I think the writing was on the wall. And I think a lot of people knew that we really weren't going to be able to use this design anymore. There were so many drugs and so few people who really were desperate for brand new drugs. And I look at my own patient population, I think I have one patient out of 350 who has truly untreatable virus with current drugs. So it's pretty hard to do a study when the numbers are so few. I think the question then is, okay, what do you do instead? And the way that Gilead has approached this with studying elvitegravir for treatment-experienced patients is to abandon that type of study design and instead compare elvitegravir with raltegravir. So you simply compare it against another drug in its class. And that way you're not denying patients access to anything, and you'll at least be able to say, well, this works as well as raltegravir. And I would assume that they wouldn't be doing this if they hadn't talked to the FDA and made sure that it was going to be acceptable to allow them to get this drug approved. So I think that's probably the way we're going to move, and maybe the way that a CCR5 antagonist should be tested in the future is just a head-to-head comparison with Maraviroc.
So, I mean, ultimately then the same kind of study that we just talked about with the quad versus the triplet, obviously for treatment experience.
Yeah, the harder thing is with the quad versus the triplet, it's easy. You're taking people who have detectable virus, who've never been treated, and you're just comparing two things that suppress their virus. So that's pretty straightforward. The problem with this new design that I'm mentioning is, let's say you give people a combination of a background regimen plus raltegravir versus a background regimen plus elvitegravir, and everybody does great. So how do you know that the integrase inhibitor had anything to do with their doing great? How do you know that they wouldn't have done great without the integrase inhibitor? Because you don't have an arm that's showing that. So the FDA could come back and say, well, maybe they were doing great because they were on a boosted PI and some nukes. You haven't shown me that your drug contributed to the success. Whereas with the quad versus the triple, well, it's obvious that it did. So it's tricky. I don't know what the answer is, but it's clearly not going to be a Toro-style design.
All right. Well, so let's then talk briefly about some of the other drugs in development that were discussed at CROI. Let's begin with, I suppose, since we just came off of Vicar Viroc, let's begin with another CCR5 antagonist in development, TBR652.
Yeah, TBR652 is another CCR5 antagonist, as you mentioned, and there was a study presented, again, by Cal Cohen, showing excellent results in a short-term study. And it was very well tolerated, as most of these drugs seem to be. What was interesting is they commented on the fact that it also seems to inhibit CCR2, which is a co-receptor that most of us haven't spent much time thinking about until now. And the argument that they made was that CCR2 has been associated with a number of inflammation-related diseases, so that perhaps this has some kind of anti-inflammatory activity as well. An interesting concept, but don't know what it will mean yet.
So just a concept? There's no actual... is there any actual proof that something that can potentially inhibit the CCR2 receptor on CD4 cells is going to help reduce any of those signs of inflammation that we have, grown increasingly accustomed to research telling us is happening in fully treated people with HIV?
Yeah, well, no, definitely. I don't think there's that kind of proof. I mean, we know that the biggest thing we do to decrease inflammation is give people antiretroviral therapy, and you see a big decrease in inflammation when you do that. But it's true that you don't get to normal levels, that people who are HIV negative have even lower rates of inflammation than people who are fully suppressed on therapy. Is it possible that blocking CCR2 could further decrease that level of inflammation? It's certainly worth looking into, but I don't think we know that yet. And, you know, whenever you block things that are part of us, you have to wonder what could be the downstream implications. So far, blocking CCR5 seems to be pretty safe, but I don't think we can just say that blocking all of these co-receptors is going to be a safe thing to do. They must be there for a reason.
And like you said, also, Maraviroc has, despite all of the hype before it was approved, it has not turned out to be a particularly popular drug. And I think, you know, price may be part of it, the trophile assay, the need to use that, certainly part of it. I think also the fact that it was approved for treatment-experienced patients, many of whom are CXCR4 tropic or dual tropic and can't benefit from the use of the drug. That might have had a role too. So given all of that, and plus given that I think the results of this particular study found that the drug did decently well in terms of suppressing viral load, but it wasn't outstanding. It didn't knock the ball out of the park necessarily. Like there wasn't like a 2-log reduction of viral load.
No, it was like a little more than a 1.5-log reduction.
So then what does that mean we're looking at as this drug moves through the development process?
Well, you know, I think if you want to think of the best possible outcome for this class of drugs, it would be that for an extra $50, when you do a baseline genotype in somebody who's just been diagnosed, you get a tropism in addition to the resistance test results. And if there are 5 tropic, you say, hey, this is a really well-tolerated, very safe class of drugs. And if I use it now, I'll get benefit from it. If I wait till later, I might not. You know, they may have lost their R5 tropism. So why not use it first? And I think that makes a lot of sense to use this incredibly well-tolerated class of drugs as early as possible. But we just can't do that right now with a $2,000 tropism assay. So I'm not dismissing this class. I think that with improvements in the laboratory tests that we use, we could definitely move these drugs up sooner. And if we had a once-a-day, very safe, well-tolerated drug, it would be a logical approach to do this early. So I think that it's worth continuing to develop these drugs as we work on the laboratory issue in tandem.
So what other pipeline drugs did CROI tell us about?
Well, we heard a little more about the GlaxoSchnogi integrase inhibitor, which I don't think has a name yet.
It does have a very long denotation, though. I think it's SGSK1349572, if I'm remembering.
Yeah,
right.
And it probably has a nickname to its friends, but I'm not privy to it. So, but this is supposed to be the first second-generation integrase inhibitor, one that will be active if you fail Isentris and Elvitegravir. And they didn't present a big clinical trial using this drug, but they did present some resistance data that suggests that that's true, that in fact no single integrase mutation will knock this out and that the common integration mutations that we see with isentrous failure will not cause cross-resistance to this drug. So that does look promising.
What else we got?
Well, that's about it. I mean, there were other drugs out there and some other ones that were talked about, but my radar screen, those were the ones that I paid attention to.
All right, so then as a whole, then, this really is not a terribly rich drug pipeline. When you consider what we were looking at when we went to CROI, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, it was a very rich, rich field of candidates. But
yeah,
this is not quite the wealth of options. And I mean, admittedly, that may just be part of the nature of having about 30 drugs that are currently approved for use. But given what you have said about Vicrovirok and the nature of studying treatment-experienced patients and the nature of trying to develop a drug that will help these people, what kind of situation is playing out for the future of HIV treatment as the current generation of treatment-experienced people, presumably, I mean, you'd said only about one out of your 300 patients that you treat have untreatable virus, meaning extreme treatment experience, significant drug resistance across the board, but presumably over the next few years, as our newer candidates spend more time out on the market, people are going to increasingly develop that level of resistance. Given that it appears to be becoming more difficult to study drugs for treatment experienced patients, and that the pipeline does not appear to be rich, what kind of situation are we facing a few years down the road? What do we say to patients who develop extreme drug resistance?
I worry about that because, I mean, if you put yourself in the shoes of some pharmaceutical company CEO, very expensive shoes, I'm sure, when you look out and say, should I develop a new HIV drug? Well, you'd be crazy to do that because it costs billions of dollars to do it and that everybody's doing just fine. Now, as you say, that may not last. We may be in a little honeymoon period where 4 or 5 years from now we're going to be facing integration resistance and extensive resistance to non-nukes and PIs, and we're going to be in trouble and without a lot of stuff to bail us out. I don't know. I mean, you know, and when I put people on so-called salvage regimens, I really explained that. I said, you know, this could be it for 5 or more years, so you really got to make this work. On the other hand, you could look at it in a more positive way and say, you know, given the situation right now, it's amazing that we have any drugs at all being developed. And I would also point out that not every drug that's in the pipeline gets presented at every meeting. So, for example, we didn't hear about the Progenics CCR5 antagonist at this one or some of the other second-generation NNRTIs. We didn't hear about rilpivirine, which is in development. So, there are drugs out there that don't get presented every time. So the pipeline is a little bigger than it would appear just looking at CROI. But I do worry about this. I'm very glad that there is, for example, a second-generation integrase inhibitor in development because I'm sure that we're going to see isentrous resistance starting to pop up. And that's going to be a hard one unless we have a drug that will rescue us from that.
Well, it sounds like that just gets more to the point that you raised just a little bit ago about how maybe this raises the importance of counseling patients on the importance of adherence and making sure that they don't face obstacles to adherence, whether it's social or psychological or financial or emotional, that may prevent them from taking their drugs as often as they need to for them to retain their effectiveness.
Oh, that's absolutely the case. You know, when you look at patients who are on these complicated multi-drug salvage regimens these days, they can kind of be divided into two groups. There's the group that developed all that resistance because they've been on drugs since the late 80s or early 90s, and through no fault of their own, they took what we gave them, and because it wasn't fully suppressive, they developed lots of resistance. That's a very common scenario, and so now they're having to take these difficult regimens. But there's also a big group who started therapy in the heart era after 1996 and who have failed because they weren't taking their medications the way they should, and they're now on these regimens. The problem is, of course, if they thought the first regimens were hard, imagine what it's like taking these ones. So we really have to make sure that people understand that a first regimen that these days is as easy as it's going to get. And if they want to continue on something like that, they need to really make sure that they take it right and don't get to the point where they're having to take salvage therapy.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
Thank you for listening to this report from CROI 2010. For more coverage of this conference, please visit us online at thebodypro.com/CROI2010.